This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
Online streaming services operating in Canada, like Netflix and Spotify, will now have to pay 5% of their Canadian revenue to help fund domestic broadcasting.
This is money that will go back into Canadian creation, whether it's music, whether it's a television series or movies, that will most likely go back on their platforms.
Canada's telecoms regulator, the CRTC, is targeting foreign-owned streaming giants to boost local, Indigenous, and French-language broadcasting. Officials say it could raise roughly $200 million each year.
The recent CRTC Bill C-11 decision mandating that streaming services pay 5% of their revenues has left seemingly everyone unhappy. Streamers think it is too much and are musing about trade or legal challenges. Canadian groups believe the actual contributions are far below what the government once promised. And consumers fear that they will ultimately foot the bill with increased subscription prices. While much of the focus has been on video streaming, music was a core part of Bill C-11, and the implications for music streaming services may be the most pronounced. Will Page is the perfect person to unpack these issues. He is the author of the critically acclaimed book Tarzan Economics, the former chief economist of Spotify and PRS for Music, the co-host of the Bubble Trouble podcast, and a regular contributor to the BBC, Financial Times, and The Economist. He joins me on the podcast to provide new data on what the CRTC's numbers could actually mean and why the decision may ultimately move the Canadian market backwards rather than forward. Will, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me onto the show. Long-time listener and a long-time follow your work, so it's really great to be contributing to the show.
Oh, that's awesome. And it's great to have you. I'm so looking forward to this conversation. You know, as you know, there's been a years-long public debate in Canada over Bill C-11, and we've even had some recent podcasts that incorporate some of the CRTC hearings and the implementation of that bill. I think it's fair to say that much of the discussion has focused primarily on film and TV production, services like Netflix and Disney. Music's always been a core part of the bill, but it hasn't gotten the same kind of attention other than early on some of the debate around music streaming on YouTube. So there's a lot to unpack and talk about some of the implications because the decisions, of course, cover both of these really in equal measure. You know, for anyone who has spent any amount of time in some of the discussion and debate around the music sector, they are generally accustomed to hearing how bad things are. I mean, that's just dating back almost a couple of decades now.
Complaining is an art form in our industry.
It sometimes seems like it, where on the one hand, there'll be press releases outside of committee rooms and the like that talk about some of the great successes, but then go into committee and start talking to politicians and it's all about how bad things are. You've tried to unpack, I know, with some of your data to take a look at the sector, especially with respect to the impact that streaming has had. So, you know, what is, particularly from a Canadian perspective, what has been the impact of streaming services essentially on the bottom line for the music sector in Canada?
The success story in Canada, I would argue, is the envy of many other developed countries around the world. And we'll get to the reason why in a second, but let's go back to the beginning. I think one of the first meetings I took in Spotify in 2012, this is the early days of the startup, we didn't have an HR department, was a Canadian trade commission had come to London. And they came to meet me. This is bizarre speaking to you, Professor Geist. They came to meet me in the London office. They said, Will, there's a website in Canada called Cantada, C-A-N-T apostrophe A-D-A. Cool things you can get in America and you can't get in Canada. Get the joke? Cantada? I said, okay. I said, and you're on the front page. The point being, Spotify had launched in America in September 2011. Technically, we only actually launched in Canada in January 2015. That was a lot of years of all of America talking about this music streaming sensation, the service called Spotify, streaming and access, and Canada being left with iTunes and CD shops. So I want to stress that when you try to understand what's happened in the Canadian music industry, it was a late adopter of streaming. It was late to the party, but it's been a great implementer. And one of the most striking slides that we shared in Canada Music Week was that trade revenues to record labels are now up 124% on 2014 prior to Spotify's proper launch. Very few countries in the developed world can claim to more than double their revenues in a decade. So a late adopter, a great implementer, and those revenues will be reflected in different amounts, different portions in the SoCan collections and the publisher revenues going to songwriters as well. This is touching all parts of the music industry. But yeah, this is the incredible story of Canada. Late to the party, but a great implementer once they were at the party. And it's a success story that's to the envy of everyone else. Now, to your point about complaining, just to put some caveats around that, which I think your audience will appreciate. Did we complain about vinyls? Of course we complained about vinyls. All songs got paid the same royalty because nobody knew what was being played. Did we complain about CDs? Of course we complained about CDs, packaging deductions for sending plastic cases out in the post. Did we complain about downloads? Yes, we complained about downloads. They unbundled the album into two or three tracks. And did we complain about piracy where I first met you in 2007? Yes, we complained about piracy. And guess what? We complained about streaming. Complaints to the constant, changes never ending. But I think the two things just to make sure that the Canadian audience appreciates about streaming, what's changed is instead of monetizing transactions, which is how media used to work for 70 years, we now monetize the consumption. In the good old days, the late 90s, where everything sold, record labels used to sell CDs to record shops by the weight of pallet. So if Michael Geiss had a record shop and I'm a record label, I say, Michael, I got a pallet of CDs here for you. You didn't ask what was on the pallet, you asked how much it weighed. Now we have this wealth of data, of analytics, of real-time analysis of what's actually being consumed. That's been the swing from the old vine to the new vine of what we're dealing with now. And the second point is to stress this audience, music matters. It's not as big as the TV or film industry, I get that, but it matters because it's always the first to suffer and always the first to recover from disruption. So there are other industries in Canada, such as newspapers, which your podcast has covered extensively, who are dealing with that transition from being a transaction-based economy to a consumption-based economy today. So the sorts of things we're going to be unpacking in this conversation are not just relevant to music, they're relevant to all of media. We're the first to suffer, we're the first to recover. So I'll try and give my answers to a broader audience as we go through.
That's a really interesting observation. And certainly the notion of more than doubling revenue during that time frame, I think, is pretty striking. Something a data point that we
Incredible.
don't a data point we don't often hear. It doesn't really advance a policy objective when you're looking for government intervention, perhaps. You talked about the fact that this platform allows for far more data. So what does the data tell us, particularly from a Canadian perspective, about the presence of Canadian artists on music streaming services? Because very often there's an economic discussion, but especially in the context of C11, there's a cultural dimension, of course, as well, and it's very much focused on, the presence of Canadian artists, and not just from an English language perspective, but then there's also a considerable emphasis on French language as well.
Well, I'm going to break it into two because I want to get into the trade-offs. I want to talk about presence of the Canadian artists. How many are there? What's the observation count? And then prominence. That is, where are these Canadian artists being found in the charts? So just to use round numbers here for the sake of ease of the conversation, in 2022, we looked at the top 10,000 artists in Canada, and about 900 of them were Canadian. Okay? And they captured about 10% of all the streams amongst that top 10,000. So what that means is we now have a nice, easy to follow 1 in 10 rule. Okay. 1 in 10 streams happening in Canada today are going to be going to Canadian artists. That obviously means 90% of streaming in Canada today is going to non-Canadian artists. We can tackle that one later on. The prominence aspect is different. Now, 1 in 10 doesn't feel that particularly high to me, but when you look at who's at the top of global charts today, you struggle not to mention Canadians, be it Drake, obviously, The Weeknd, obviously, Tate McRae, who's up and coming, is going to be topping those charts in 2025, to countless other artists who would be considered major global stars, happen to be Canadians. So, what I want to get across to the audience is on the presence side, is 1 in 10 too low, about right, too high? Well, you Canadians can tell me. For me, it feels a bit on the low side. It really does. But on the prominent side, you tick all the boxes and then some. So you have a trade-off. So what do you want your policy to solve? Do you want to optimize for presence, or do you want to optimize for prominence? Now, if you pardon me while I quote our former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, I'm about to add another former to that as well. He talked about cakeism. You can't have your cake and eat it. So what I was trying to do for the CRTC's benefit is to understand this trade-off of, will this policy affect presence, or will it affect prominence, or will it affect neither? Will it affect both? But there's an intuitive trade-off there in terms of what you're trying to capture. And then you also asked about language. Well, that's
Yes.
interesting. So let's just take that 900 artists and sort of unpack them a little bit. Around about 75% of them performed in English, and around 20% performed in French. And other languages, Punjabi, made up the residual effect. But that's an observation count, okay? And from an observation perspective, that should be, for those who are of a nationalistic persuasion, broadly reassuring, because that's kind of reflective of Canadian populations. Remember, there's nothing stopping an English artist performing in a different language or a French artist performing in a different language. That's artistic freedom. And there's nothing wrong with instrumentals which don't have lyrics. But broadly speaking, 20% of the observation count were French artists was interesting. But I think what really interested me, and again, this is where I really hope the CRTC has followed this work, is as you unpack the data, that's an observation of 900 artists, tick box of English, tick box of French, tick box of Punjabi. In terms of screen share, not the observations, but the streams coming from those observations, the second most streamed language in Canada today is Punjabi, followed by Spanish and then by French. And that's jaw-dropping in terms of what is Canadian music. You have that maple definition, which I'm the student, you're the professor here. But then we're talking about a country where Punjabi is the second most streamed language. That's incredible. And then can I add to that? We're seeing Canadian Indian artists now breaking back in India. So, policy is complicated. It involves trade-offs. I'm trying to put on the table here all the different policy variables you could try and move here with your actions, and the trade-offs that could occur as you begin to try and move them. That was the goal of the report, not to pick one side or the other, but just to give you choices.
Yeah, and I should note that the report itself will be putting in the show notes so people will be able to have access to that, to the full report and see the data for themselves. I want to get to those policy choices in just one sec, but there is one at least a bit of almost an elephant in the room when it comes to some of these streaming services, because there's often talk about the revenues that they generate for artists and a lot of concern that gets expressed around that, especially when there are attempts to compare that to radio-related revenues. Your report suggests that these comparisons are a bit apples to oranges, or I think the report seems to look more like an apple to pear. But in any event, we're talking about different kinds of fruits. Can you explain what you mean by that, and once you start unpacking what's really taking place, how you think we should be thinking about the differential in revenues that exist between these different media?
100%. Now, let me just get some Canadian colloquialisms here. What do Canadians say? Do you say apples to oranges or apples to pears?
We would say apples to oranges.
Okay, that's where we differ. Okay,
Yeah.
that's where the rubber hits the road. That's what the
Okay.
Atlantic Divide has done to our countries.
Exactly.
Okay, apples to oranges. So, a little bit of context here. This debate about Spotify payouts, this debate about what streaming pays artists, has gone on since 2008. And I've been using the same example since 2008 to explain it to people who are angry about it. Typically, a manager will hold me by the neck and say, "Spotify's not paying me enough." And I'm going to walk you through the same example I walked that manager through back then with very little difference. And every time I explain this, the manager puts me back on the ground and offers to buy me a drink and apologizes. It's education. This is not a political statement I'm going to give you. It's just an education of an apple on one side and an orange on another. So let's just go to a Canadian radio station. We'll pick on Boom 97.3 Radio, which I listen to in my hotel room at Toronto. And we're going to take a top show that they would have, which would probably get to around about 700,000 people. Okay. Now, if your song gets played on Boom 97.3 on the most prominent show that that station has, what are you going to see from that show? Probably $20 Canadian to the songwriter, that would go via SoCan, and another $10 to the artist. That would go via resound. 20 plus 10 gets you to 30. So now I'm saying that if you get played on radio, you get $30 for a play. Then you compare that to Spotify, which is going to pay you half a penny per stream. And you might look at that in disgust and say, why on earth should I do this dance with streaming? I get $30 for a play on radio and half a penny for a play on streaming. But you need to do the division. You need to take that $30 and you have to divide it by the audience, that 700,000 listenership, to get to the comparable unit of the value per user per stream. And I'm going to say a lot of zeros here, but what that results in is 0.00043. That's four zeros after the decimal point, which is 1% of the 0.005 that you would get from streaming. And let's just remember, these are not mutually exclusive. If I hear that song on Boom 97.3, and then on my commute to work playlist, add that song to my play, I'll get all that money back again. So the key thing here is to understand the nature of the per stream as a unique per person, per listen valuation. It is not broadcast, which is one to many, radio, it's narrowcast, it's many one to ones. And countless people get confused with that metric. A second point is just to stress when I hear the claim, Spotify doesn't pay artists. I say, correct. No streaming service, Spotify, Apple, Amazon, YouTube pays artists. They pay aggregators. They will contract with aggregators, be them record labels, be them independent labels, be them Merlin, an independent aggregator. Be it DIY platforms like DistroKid, which are responsible for one in three songs released on planet Earth last year. And those aggregators then pay the artist. Contractually, as we have a large legal audience listening to this, the contract is between Spotify and the distributor, and then a separate contract between the distributor and the artist. So a lot of the criticism of this platform is misplaced. Either A, they don't understand the economics, or B, they don't understand the law. And that has been the case now for about 15 plus years. So education, education, education. We need to do a better job of educating the songwriters and the artists who are at the end of this value chain, asking why is that check what it is.
Okay. Well, that debate, as you say, has been ongoing for a long time, and it hasn't penetrated yet, but perhaps this will help people be able to better make distinguish between revenue driven from a large broadcast as opposed to the more one-to-one on-demand in many instances approach that you can find on a Spotify. Why don't we move to some of the regulatory related
Sure.
issues, because that's really where the rubber hits the road, so to speak, in terms of some of these issues. The CRTC has talked about the issue of discoverability mandates, and you talked about the percentage of Canadian artists that appear on the platform, or that people amongst that top 10,000. The government had expressed concern. I think some in the industry expressed concern, so then the government expressed concern about percentage of Canadian artists, and talked a little bit about that already. And so they feel that one way to try to address that would be to force platforms, both video and audio, to make Canadian content more prominent. And there will be a debate about what Canadian content means, but we will park that to the side. For the moment, where much of the concern has lay involves the prospect of the regulator either directly or indirectly getting into the notion of algorithmic regulation, basically requiring platforms who make many of the decisions in terms of what people are presented with through algorithms based on their other viewing habits or the viewing habits or listening habits of others. What are some of your thoughts around that form of regulation?
Well, I'll say straight from the get-go, whenever you hear people on conferences or on stages say I'm an expert in the algorithm, you kind of know they're lying. You really do. And I'll just openly admit my own lack of understanding from the algorithm. If I go all the way back to 2015, where we were working on Discover Weekly, which is, I think, the first true scalable algorithmic playlist in the history of music. You know, within 2 or 3 months of launching Discover Weekly, which gave the listener 30 unique songs just for their own listening tastes, we had like 40 million people getting 40 million unique play songs. It changed media forever. Now it's taken as a given, but let's go back to where it began, the Discover Weekly playlist every Monday. I remember thinking for months, maybe years afterwards, surely saves and ads and shares from that playlist is going to send a signal back to the playlist, which makes it work even better for me. And we realized, no, it doesn't. because the algorithm is built around signals of people like you that are around you, not by your own actions. So I just want to caveat this answer by saying it's very easy to claim you're an expert in the algorithm, but unless you actually worked on it firsthand, there's lots that we don't know. Now, let's go to the algorithm and the prominence debate that you had in Canada. I sit on the board of the British Green Forum in the UK, and I got a little prelude to this debate where we had our Ofcom media bill going through, which is looking for prominence on the tech services video platforms for local public sector broadcasters. So if you went to the Amazon Prime TV homepage, you would see the BBC content right there or the ITV content right there. Amazon Prime, let's read Netflix in America, you would see the CBC content right there on their homepage. So you can get the Canadian comparison. And then the tech companies are saying, well, we design our homepage to serve our fans. We don't want interference with that homepage, which could risk our ability to A, acquire subscribers and B, retain them. Bit of a storm in a teacup, the design of a homepage, and I'm not quite sure how much actually matters. I search for the content I'm after, regardless of the homepage. But the trade-off, cakeism, the trade-off is there for you to understand and appreciate. For the algorithm, it's tricky. First things first, the CRTC have a myth-busting website which says, and I'm going to quote, "Fact, we will not regulate the algorithm. We want to encourage innovation to make Canadians and Indigenous content easier to find." So they're not going to go after algorithm intervention. That's important to acknowledge because I've heard on previous conversations you've discussed this as a risk and maybe events, dear boy, events, the law changes and they do go after the algorithm. But currently, that is loud and clear on their own website. I checked this morning. Why would it be unwise to go for that? I think it's just worth explaining how the algorithm works. If the algorithm was to pick up on my favorite Canadian band, which is a band called Jets Overhead from British Columbia outside of Vancouver, long loved them for the best part of 13 years now, then what you want the algorithm to do is to pair you with the biggest band in the world, similar to that content, so you can fall into that slipstream and scale with that artist. So maybe Jets Overhead are similar to Imagine Dragons, an American band. So you want the algorithm to pair you with Imagine Dragons, so you get that boost, that rising tide lifts all boats effect. If you had geo-blocking in the algorithm, I would have to pair Jets Overhead to a similar type of Canadian band. And the lift might not be that great because you only get one bite on the cherry. Hopefully that colloquialism translates. You only get one shot. You can't have your cake and eat it. I'm quoting Boris Johnson again, cakeism. You can't say, pair me with a Canadian band and pair me with a global rock star band, and that will tick the CRTC box. That doesn't happen. So I think that's one example of why messing with the algorithm could potentially do more harm than good. But the presence prominence debate is interesting. Where there could be some feasible wiggle room, and I kind of alluded to this in the report, is don't intervene in the makeup of the playlist. Maybe there's a top playlist on a music service which has 75 songs. If you had presence, let's say 50 of those 75 songs were Canadian, you'd be really happy, right? What if I told you they were from tracks 26 to 75 in the rank of that playlist? You've ticked the presence box, but you haven't got the prominence box. Option B, there's a playlist on Spotify which has got 75 songs on it. 8 of them are Canadian, and they're all in the top 15 on the rank. That is, the first 15 songs that playlist goes through will have 8 Canadian songs in it. Trade-offs, once again. Do you want presence or do you want the prominence? Don't fool yourself, you can have both. And I think that's a lever that people like yourselves, people like the CRTC, can get their hands dirty with in terms of what would good look like if you intervened in this market.
Okay, I mean another really helpful to better understand that sometimes you get something that you think is going to improve the situation, but perhaps once you start unpacking it, it may not actually get you where you were hoping for. You
To
know,
quote a
I
Scottish poet, the best laid plans of mice and men,
there
correct?
you go, indeed. You know, you I'm glad you moved towards sort of that global perspective in terms of, you know, trying to prioritize Canadian artists, Canadian creators, and what that might mean once you start going once you start engaging globally. That engaging globally was really at the heart of much of the discussion around C11, especially on the video side, where you had digital first creators talking about the successes that they'd seen on platforms like YouTube or TikTok, and emphasized really the export markets, the revenue that they were generating from outside of Canada. What does the data tell us about the situation for musical artists in terms of where the revenue is drawn from? And this, of course, has, again, big implications for some of the kind of policy choices that you make if you're thinking about things primarily from a domestic perspective rather than a global one.
Right, so this is an absolute passion point of mine, and it's going to involve a word that, if you have a Scottish accent, is very, very hard to pronounce, called glocalization. We'll come to that in a second. Don't touch that dial, as the radio DJ would say. But firstly, let's just hit you with a very quick bit of math. The current numbers that we did, and we fact-checked this, with Luminate data, with Spotify data, is that for every one stream at home that Canadians are getting, so those 1 in 10 streams in Canada are Canadian. For each of those one streams of Canadian artists at home, they're getting 10 overseas. Which the knee-jerk reaction says, wow, what an opportunity overseas. But let's just be careful. This is a very intelligent, street-smart audience that you have, Professor Geist. Ratios can be misleading. Perhaps it should be 1 in 5, but the domestic streams are too low. Ratios are a double-sided coin. Perhaps it should be 1 in 20, and 10's not enough. Look at the size of the global market. So what does 1 in 10 tell you? It tells you that there is an overseas opportunity that's worth exploiting. And maybe with from ratios to absolute numbers, I would say there's about 700 million people in the world paying to use music. And I would say little over 1% of them are actually in Canada. So, as Vanessa Bakewell famously taught me, go fishing where the fish are. Number one rule of marketing. There's more fish outside of Canada than there is in. So you need to think about an export strategy. Now, two quick remarks on that. Had you been interviewing me this time last year, we wouldn't know what the word glocalization actually meant. I hadn't published a London School of Economics paper. Now it's part of our lexicon. What we are seeing around the world is that for English-speaking markets, to which Canada is predominantly one of, it's about to get very tough because local markets are turning to local content in their local mother tongue. In Germany, German festivals sell out with German bands singing in German now. We don't need the English-speaking bands, the Arcade Fires of this world, to come and headline our festivals. In Spain, the entire chart is Spanish language, but it's all Latin American. In small European countries, and I'm going to give you a very important example, Denmark, which has got the population the equivalent of Scotland. 9 of the top 10 artists in Denmark last year were Danish singing in Danish. And the record labels will say, why don't you sing in English? I could export you. At least Swedish people could understand you if you sang in English. And the artists say, no, we want to sing in Danish. We make it work just fine. And lastly, to stress just how the tide has turned against what used to be the comparative advantage of the English language. Brazil, as an exclusive, I confirmed today there is no international artist, be it English language or Spanish language, in the Brazilian YouTube chart as of today. We knew it was getting low. I checked last month and Bruno Mars was there at rank 87, meaning the 86 artists above him were singing in Portuguese. Now there is none. So we need to rethink the export opportunity. It's there, but how do you get there? And a point I made on stage, and I wanted to make to yourself, is if you look at the websites of Factor and StarMaker, and I love what these organizations try to do. I know the closer you look, the more warts that you see and the more bickering that you learn about in terms of how these work in practice. But I love the notion of what these organizations try to do. I don't think the websites are future-proof for what's about to hit the English-speaking world. I think you need a much more advanced, app-based, API integrated ability to register your songs, register your funding, access your cash, monitor your streams, promote your work, and demonstrate the success of the investment. You're asking for these platforms to pay taxes. Show those taxes are being put to use effectively. And I think there's a lot of work to be done, regardless of the policy debate. Whatever you decide in Canada, the mechanisms to implement that policy need to deal with these radical changes in the local market. The English-speaking world better get used to globalization because this force is not going away.
What one of the criticisms throughout the policy process was just the lack of attention to what was taking place globally. And so this is exactly the kind of information that at times was missing. You mentioned the taxes or the mandated payments that the streaming services are going to be required to pay. In some ways, this discussion has really been building to that point to establish the foundation of what we've got in Canada right now, who's been benefiting, some of the risks and some other challenges. But all of this kind of crystallizes with the CRTC's recent ruling of a mandated payment to 5% of Canadian revenues. And one of the things right out of the gate with that decision was some noting that the impact, if you were a video streaming service like like a Netflix may well be different than if you're an audio service like a Spotify. Let's talk about Spotify or audio, those kinds of services. How do you expect that it's going to affect that kind of service? How do you think they might respond? And perhaps even more importantly, since it's a question you always get in Canada, what is everyone else doing? How does what we're seeing unfold here in Canada from a regulatory cost perspective compare to what takes place elsewhere?
So, Professor Geist, let's stick with this Canadian colloquialism you've given me of apples and oranges and refer to radio, the incumbent contributor to the CRTC, as the apple, and streaming, this new entrant to Ottawa, as the orange. And what I really want your audience to think about are the effects of this asymmetric shock on these two organizations. I'm going to give you some robust calculations to show, arguably, and it is an argument, how disproportionate this 5% figure is. Now, this is an evidence-based opinion. It is an opinion. Where possible, I'll try and give you some countering views to get some balance into our dialogue here. So I'm going to give you three calculations. I'm going to layer them on top of each other in a logical order and let the first, identify the corporate distinctions which make radio and streaming structurally different from a financial perspective. Second, the disproportionate size of these contributions that streaming is going to have to pay vis-a-vis radio. And third, these contributions in an absolute context relative to the operational cost of being in the country. So let's take our first of our three. And the big takeaway before we get numerical here is that I want to show you and your audience that streaming is in a straitjacket cost-wise. It doesn't have any wiggle room to take this contribution. So to do that, let's take some evidence. Let's look at the CRTC documentation on radio statistical and financial summaries. It was truly great bedtime reading. But if you look at that document, what you'll see is a reference to COGS, that is what radio has to pay to SOCAN for the songwriters, to ReSound for the artists, their rights holder payments. We're going to call that COGS. It's just 7%. And their operating expenditure for running their operation, be it the ad sales team, the management salaries, and so on, that's 85%. And the rest is what you're going to call margin. 7 and 85. When we go to streaming, boy, does it change. Streaming has got payments rights holders, that COGS term, record labels, 55%, publishers, 15%, 70% in total is their COGS base. Not 7 like radio, but 70. And their operating expenditure is not 85%, it's just 25%, leaving a wafer thin margin for gross margin. Now look at that. COGS, payments rights holders, that doesn't change. That's often set down in law. So you don't get any leeway on that front. So it has to come out of OPEX. And the operating expenditure for streaming services is a lot smaller than it is for radio. This, therefore, it's less able to accommodate this shock. So streaming is in a straitjacket when faced with these CRTC contributions vis-a-vis radio. That's point one. We've established the straitjacket it's in. Now I want to move to point two, which is, how disproportionate is a shock to the system given the straitjacket that streaming services are in? So let's just go back to our math for a second. The radio payments rights holders, their COGS is 7%. Streaming is 70%. So streaming's got a 10 times cost base than radio has. But then look at the contributions. Radio pays 0.4 to the factors, to the star maker organizations across Canada, which do great work, but it is a 0.4 contribution. And streaming are being asked to pay 5. Well, that's 12.5 times the size of what radio pays. Add them all together. Radio is now paying 7.4 through into the value chain. Streaming is paying 75, 10.1 times what radio pays. So streaming is faced with a bill that's 10 times greater than radio, but has a straitjacket structure, which means it's less able to accommodate it. Kick a man when they're down, please. Now, I stress we need to keep balance here as our counter. You could produce a counter by, instead of reading across the rows of these calculations, read down the columns. 0.4 into 7.4 is 5.4%. So contributions as a share of total payments rights holders and Ottawa is 5.4%. Whereas 5 into 75 is 6.7%. So you could argue, and it'd be mischievous to do so, but you could argue that the contributions as a share of rights holder payments is broadly similar. But that misses what the rows tell you, which is no, is that streaming is paying 10 times what radio pays in overall costs. Last of these calculations, Now, what I want to do is ask the question of, is it worth operating in Canada? Well, that's a bit pessimistic, but what I really want to hit home is, you run an operation in Canada, is it going to be worth it given this new operational cost of being in the country? So, some quick maths. If you look at the IFPI yearbook in US dollar, not Canadian loonies here, we're going to say that streaming is worth half a billion in Canada. Half a billion from the Spotifys, the Amazons, the YouTubes, the Apples, half a billion in revenues to record labels. Let's give Spotify a two-thirds share of that. That means they're walking out with $330 million. Let's scale that up based on their revenue share and ask what's their gross revenue. That would now hit $600 million. And we're going to take 5% of that and give it to the CRTC. That means your bill, when the waiter comes over from Ottawa, is $30 million a year. And an informed guess, I think Spotify's operation in Canada costs maybe around $10 million a year. The ad sales team, the comms, the labor relations folks. So that means that this new contribution on top of their straitjacket cost base, on top of their payments to rights holders, which is 10 times what radio has to pay, their new contributions are going to be three times what the operational costs of their Canadian office comes to. So there you have it. Streaming has less flexibility to absorb these costs vis-a-vis radio. They then need to absorb a cost that's 12 times the size of what radio pays in absolute terms. And they're going to be making contributions that are three times the size of their operational cost of being in Canada in the first place. Does this spell welcome to Canada to you?
Well, I think it's pretty clear. It's self-evident, I think, what it spells. It spells for companies that are already operating here, they're going to pass the costs along. And for companies that aren't operating here, they look at those kinds of costs and raise serious questions about whether or not Canada is a place where they want to do business.
I would agree with that, but let's just tag you on a couple of words there. You said pass the cost along. I want to turn to the next question, which is a really thorny one, which is who do they pass those costs along to? Now, you had a fine article which came out, I think, within hours of the decision coming through. I don't know how you work so fast, but you pointed the finger at the consumer. I believe that might be a little bit misjudged because this is a share of revenue. This is not a tax like you'd have in France. For that, you can hold your cost of goods constant, raise price, pay the tax, consumer pays. I see that argument, but this is different. My understanding, and I'm the student, you are a professor here, is this is a share of revenue. So whilst you have instance in Uruguay, which is chump change to the Canadians, but very important, Spotify threatened to leave the country if that issue was not resolved. You have the issue of France, which we'll come to, but that again is a tax on top of the current cost structure that can be accommodated through price rises. This is a share of revenue. And what I wanted to draw your audience's attention to is where there's precedent, and that is Spain. So let's pack our bags and go to Spain for a minute. In Spain, Spotify will pay 55% to record labels, 15% to publishers, and then an AIE top-up levy, as it were, to the featured and non-featured artists through actual remuneration. Now, very important here, the headline rate for that levy, that tax, was 5.6%. It is discounted to 2.4%. It's a completely different part of the world from Canada, but interesting that the initial charge was 5, similar to Canada. It's been discounted down to 2.4. Now, who carries the weight, to quote Kool and the Gang here? Is it going to be Spotify, or do labels have to accommodate that within their licensing structure? That is, labels license at 55 minus 2.4, and publishers get their 15, and Spotify hold their margin constant. That's the question that then turns to. And I think the Spanish example is a really, really important one to know that that exists. And last year, I published a paper for WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, an institution that your audience will know well, on equitable remuneration. And if you link it in your show notes, your audience can get to that and understand how that Spanish top-up model actually works.
You've highlighted some of the costs here, and I mean, they're startling when you start comparing where Canada's at and the sector is at compared to others. But if you were made, why don't we close with this? If you were made chair for the day, no one's offering me that, but maybe someone might offer you that. If you were made chair for the day, what would you recommend that we see from a policy and a regulatory perspective, based on, as we started with, a data-driven, evidence-based approach?
Well, evidence-based policymaking, not policy-based evidence-making. And one of the golden rules that you're taught as a government economist is option one, no matter how many options you want to toss up into the air, is do nothing. It's evaluate the status quo. Show me the case for intervention vis-a-vis just stepping back and letting the market continue what the market is doing. And what frustrates me most is I don't think that question was asked or answered in the decision-making process, what we heard 2 weeks ago. That is, we went straight into we have to intervene. On the eighth day, God said the CRTC has to intervene in global streaming platforms. Do they? Will it do more harm than good? Will it, as your previous colleague suggests, just move money around and make collaboration harder and make Canada less competitive? Will the unintended consequences out overshadow the intentions of the policy itself? I get what is trying to be done here. I empathize with the direction of travel. And I stressed the Canadians are trying to climb a mountain no one else has climbed before. There's no textbook or MBA course saying, here's how to regulate on-demand, non-linear streaming services. That doesn't exist. And that's why the world is watching you guys. No one's tried this. You've tried this. But I'm genuinely a bit upset that nobody's shown the rationale for intervention. It's been assumed as a given. And when that happens in policymaking, you tend to screw up. You tend to fail to have checked all the boxes, turned the stones over in the process. But then, who am I? From Scotland, don't live in Canada, don't vote in Canada. I've got no skin in your game, but I'd love for this thing to work out. But I think that's the main thing is to understand, had you not intervened in the market, would things have been that much better or that much worse? Show me the counterfactual, build the opportunity cost. And then again, just to reiterate just how fast the market is changing and how slow policy changed. We talked about the export market opportunity. On stage, I released an exclusive data point, which is in terms of where Canada is being streamed outside of its own country. And it was interesting. 38% was in United States, 32% in Europe, 14% in Asia Pacific, 12% in Latin America. All right, there's some data, meta that if you want. But that's going to change rapidly over the coming years. And I just wish the focus was on the changing market at home and abroad, and accommodating those changes, such as what if I put that pie chart up? And what if I came to Canada next year and showed that Europe is now a bigger market for Canadian artists than America? What have you learned that? What would you do policy-wise to adapt to that, to accelerate that, to build and compound the growth on that trend? That for me is progressive policymaking for the Canadian music industry, not slamming a 5% levy on streaming services, which already pays 70% to rights holders, which is 1,150% greater, relatively speaking, than the radio counterparts in your country. I don't think Canada's going to be high on the priority list of the global marketing departments that run these companies anymore. And that's where I worry. The best laid plans of mice and men, this could move the market backwards, not forwards.
There's been, I think, an absence of identifying some of the risks of policy, and just with an emphasis that that more money and more regulation is somehow just going to make everyone better off, perhaps at the cost of higher consumer costs. But I think you've done a really effective job of highlighting that there's more to this than there's just that, and that there are some real potential consequences that may come up along the way.
Let's go back to where we began back in 2012, my first meeting, that website called Canada. I don't know if that website still exists now, but if this is the path of intervention, are we going to see a reemergence of Canada.com with other cool things that Americans can get, but they can't get in Canada because of the interventionist nature of the government? That would be an unintended consequence that I would be very regretful of. I want this to work, but I don't think, as a chapter one, we've got off on the right foot here at all.
Okay. Well, I've had some fantastic information, some really great perspectives. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter @LawBitesPod or Michael Geist @MGeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe via RSS at Apple Podcast, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for the clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes for this episode at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.